Tonight on Arena, Sound of Metal, Sequin in a Blue Room, and A Common Crime with the movies up for review. And we speak with Belfast band New Pagans about their debut album. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And it's with films that we will start on this Thursday evening up for review. Sequin in a Blue Room, the story of a teenager who's exploring his sexuality through an obsession with anonymous, no-strings sexual encounters. Argentinian film. A Common Crime, where a woman is tormented by guilt when she comes to believe that her actions contributed to someone being killed. We'll start, however, with the 6 Oscar nominations garnered by Sound of Metal, the story of a heavy metal drummer's life being thrown into freefall when he begins to lose his hearing. I'm joined by Caro Doherty and Paul Whittington. An interesting setup, I suppose, in this particular film, Sound of Metal. Paul, give us an idea of what's involved.
Yeah, it's a very interesting. The idea has been knocking around for a while. Kian France came up with it and was going to direct it himself at one point. And Darius Marder, rather, took over. Rhys Ahmed, who's Oscar nominated and deservedly so, plays Ruben, who's a drummer, as you say, in a death metal or punk metal band with his girlfriend Lou, who's played by Olivia Cooke. They tour small venues across the middle America. They live together in a customised RV and they seem kind of happy, but there are problems. Both are recovering addicts, and at one point the camera hints that Lou has self-harmed and may even have attempted suicide. Anyway, one morning after a concert, Ruben begins to notice that his hearing is impaired, and at first he's in denial, and then that becomes the driving force of the whole film.
Right, well, let's actually get a scene, a short clip from quite early on, that scene where you're talking about Ruben has realised that his hearing is gone. He's drumming on stage when it happens. He leaves the stage, runs outside gasping for air. Lou follows him out. And what we hear now is the scene from Ruben's point of view. There you go, a scene there from Sound of Metal. It really is disorientating, or at least it was for me, Cara, when that scene happens quite early on. You're wondering, what are they doing with the sound here? What's actually going on? But it gives you a sense of the type of disorientation that the character of Ruben himself is going through.
It's quite remarkable. Like you say, at the start, I was quite confused. I was like, is this me? I'm not sure what's going on here. And the more we get into it and we realise this is now how he is hearing things. And it gets worse as he goes along. He's told he has 80% hearing loss. And if he wants to save that last 20%, he needs to get away from music and everything that's loud in the hopes of sort of being able to salvage that little bit of sound. But it, as daft as it may sound to hear, I kind of assumed when people, if they were in the process of going deaf, that maybe the things would just become quieter or more muffled. I didn't realise that static, that jumbled and distorted. And I just thought that was astounding that's what people have to go through. And it's amazing the way it's done. And then when sound returns to how hearing people hear it, everything is so loud in the film. And it makes you just realise that actually, if you can hear, our environments are so noisy around us, but we've obviously become accustomed to that as well.
Often when I'm watching these screeners, I turn on subtitles anyway so that you catch everything. But this is actually, even if you don't turn on the subtitles, it's captioned and it's there. Everything is described in the way it would be if you had subtitles on Netflix or on any other video platform, which I guess is for those who are deaf as well, who are watching the film. And interesting, Paul, that there are deaf actors and hearing actors involved in the piece.
Yeah, there are. And Sean, I tried to turn the captions off at the start, as I usually do, and then I realised that you can't. But this would be a very interesting film without the sound production, but the sound production is extraordinary. But yes, as you say, there are hearing people and deaf people in the film, and his journey, it's almost Reuben, that is, he almost goes through the seven stages of grief because he goes to stay in the sanctuary run by this very interesting Vietnam veteran called Joe, who's played by Paul Ratchie. And his centre, his refuge, his learning place, their whole philosophy is that being deaf is not a handicap. It's not something you need to fix. But Reuben has it in his head that if he pays $40,000 for this cochlear implant, he will get his own life back.
And that debate, does that become an important part of the film, Cara? This the idea that, you know, rather than try to, in inverted commas, fix deafness, you accept the deafness and change your life accordingly. Is that an important theme and topic?
It is. It's a big theme in it. The centre that that Reuben goes to, that their whole foundation is first learning how to be deaf and how to be deaf in a hearing world, but also learning to accept that and not seeing it in any way as a disadvantage. And it's very new to him, and he's obviously in shock and he's startled, and he just wants his old life back. But Joe, who runs the centre, very much wants him to understand that if he is to stay with their community, he needs to learn to embrace being deaf and not see it in any way as something that will hinder him. But obviously for somebody that has just happened to, it's a very traumatic thing, so that decision weighs very heavily.
Yeah, we were talking about this upstairs, the difference between somebody who is perhaps deaf from birth or deaf from a very young age versus somebody who suddenly becomes deaf in adulthood, that I suppose there are big differences involved there. However, Paul, this isn't just a film about the story of Reuben's deafness and what happens to his hearing. It's also about addiction. It's about the world of rock and roll and the type of life that's lived there. Let's listen to a clip between Lou. She's the singer in the band and in a relationship with Reuben. They have to separate, obviously, as Reuben undergoes counselling for his hearing loss, and she knows just how destructive things can be when they're together, but she doesn't want to separate, and there's strong language in this clip.
Ah, Jesus, Lou, come on.
Reuben, you hurt yourself? Reuben, you hurt yourself? You hurt me. I'll hurt myself too.
Yeah.
Promise. Say it, Ruby, or all of this is for shit. Say it. Promise. Go back there right now. Promise. Say it.
I promise if you...
No, say it. Promise. Go back to that place.
I need you to wait for me. Okay? You're it for me, Lou. You're my fucking heart. You're it for me. Okay? You gotta wait for me. Listen to me. Listen. When you get there, I need you to write to me, okay? Yeah? Will you write me? Will you tell me you're okay? Huh? Promise me? And listen, if it's bullshit, you just get your ass back here. I'll fix it. I swear to God. You know I'll fucking fix this. It's not that hard, okay? Just come back here.
I love
My
you.
Fucking heart. Okay?
Olivia Cooke as Lou and Riz Ahmed as Reuben there in a scene from Sound of Metal. Paul, as I say, clearly a lot more at play here than the story of the deafness. But 6 Oscar nominations, does it deserve them? Do you think it'll win some of them?
Whether it'll win some is another question entirely. I think obviously for sound production it will. It's a given. Riz Ahmed is up against some, you know, like people like obviously the late Chadwick Boseman and so on. So I don't know, but he certainly would be a deserved winner if he did win. It's a very interesting film. I think it's very rare for films to make you think, and also to, at the same time, to make you understand just how much you take for granted every day. So yeah. I think it's a very special film.
Stars from you, Paul?
Yeah, I think I'd go for, as much as I love half stars, as you know, Sean, I think I'll go for a full 5 on this one.
A full five?
Yeah, full 5, yeah.
I thought you were saying a 4 or 5 because you didn't want to say 4.5. It's a 5, a full 5 from you. And Cara, it is a long film. I wondered, did it take a long time to set itself up, or does it merit its almost 2 hours of viewing?
I think it is a tad on the long side. It is a wonderful film, and really Riz's performance is amazing. But I just couldn't go to the 5. It just needed a bit of a trim in there for me.
Right.
I would have said 4, but you know, I'm going to annoy Paul now and say 4.5. I know he's
4.5.
That is annoying. Yeah.
Okay, so 5 and 4.5 for Sound of Metal from Karen Paul. Let's move on then to film number 2, Sequin in a Blue Room. I beg your pardon. A chance encounter at an anonymous sex party. A boy hunts through the world of a hookup app to track down the mystery man involved. It's a story of a young gay. He's a boy turning into a man. He's in his teens somewhere, but it's not. Not about his discovering his sexuality. It's not a coming out film. This is really about online sex and the perils of the online world, Cara.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's refreshing that it's not a coming out. We need to see more stories about gay people that just aren't around coming out. But it is about, and I sound like an old person to say this, but the fear of how online dating and dating apps are literally at the end of a fingertip. And you've got a 16-year-old boy who is full of raging hormones. He knows that he can attract older men. He has form with that. And when you're raging hormones and you've literally got a city of men waiting for you, it's very hard to swipe. I'm not sure what direction you go for not wanting it. Either way, he spends far too much time out there hooking up with older men, and because he is just a kid, he gets out of his depths, and he really, he should be hanging around with lads his own age. I sound like a mammy now.
Yeah, he does find himself in a lot of trouble, and I suppose it is as much, it could be a heterosexual story as much as a homosexual story in that respect. This, the nature of hookup sex, again, to sound like somebody's daddy at this point in time, Paul. But it is important here that it's not making a judgment around casual sex or anything like that. The film, it really is about, you have a think about what you're doing when you swipe, whatever way it is, right or left.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I agree, it could be a film about heterosexuals, except for the fact that when he goes to this club in the middle of it and meets this person he falls in love with, or sees this person he falls in love with, you're in a world, you know, unleavened by any female influence. So that's a difference. And I think the other sort of key encounter he has is with this young fella called Tommy at his school, is played by Simon Croker. And Tommy is where he should really be, because Tommy is still going, am I gay? Am I not gay? The way somebody would have a long time ago. And he's, you know, looking at graphic novels, and he's trying, and he's tentatively asking Sequin out. But Sequin is way beyond that. He has a kind of addiction to this casual sex. And when he meets this older married man who goes by the moniker B, he ends up in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, it really does become nasty. But let's listen to it. It's so cute that the way the relationship is growing between Tommy and Sequin. And here's a scene. Simon Croker is Tommy, Sequin played by Conor Leach, and Tommy wants to ask Sequin out.
What are you doing after this?
Going to class?
No, I mean, after school.
Oh, undecided yet?
Yeah. Hey, a few of us were thinking of going to the movies tonight. Some cheesy love story, I'd rather die, but we thought it'd be a good way to knock out this assignment. Might even smuggle in some vodka cruises.
Whoa. Well, have fun.
Well, would you like to come join us?
Are you asking me on a date?
No. I could.
Okay,
Really? Awesome. Cool.
Oh, that you just want to take him home and mind him. That's Tommy, played by Simon Croker, asking Sequin, played by Conor Leach, out on a date. I'm not sure that I fully agree with Paul. I thought Tommy was pretty clear on where his sexuality was in this case, but he's so shy and so innocent in comparison to the experience of Sequin, Cara.
Yeah, I think so. I think that Sequence is miles ahead in some aspects. But really, at the end of the day, he is just a 16-year-old kid who's gotten so caught up in this world, and he's not ready for it yet. He needs to find the balance between Tommy and the older men that he's been hanging out with at night. So there's balance to be found. So let's hope himself and Tommy worked out and had a nice pace and figure things out together.
Yeah, for sure. It's a film that, a bit like Sound of Metal, Paul, when it starts out, I wasn't sure what world I was in, particularly when we went into this blue room, this anonymous sex room that the parties take place, where there are no names, no contacts, no follow up, no strings attached. But as it moved along, it kind of opens itself up in a very moving type of way.
Yeah, it does. And another interesting thing that it gets at, Sean, is the contrasting experiences of gay men across different generations. Because B, this rather angry man whose phone he steals, the older man he meets, he obviously came from a time and place in Australia where it was too high a risk for him to admit who he really was. Whereas Sequin, his dad, is this very, you know, his dad is, you know, totally understanding of everything and asks him about his dates and everything. So it's just things have moved on, but the challenges are still there. They're just different.
Yeah, and we should point out, you mentioned it there, Paul, it is an Australian film. Not that that makes any difference particularly, but it is an Australian film. Yeah. And the Sequin that he has is a kind of a handle that he has online regarding a top that he wears. By the way, you can all stop pretending that you don't know that you swipe right for a yes at this point in time, the pair of you. let us move on then. Oh, sorry, I didn't get stars from you for that. From you, first of all, Paul.
I like this film. I saw it first over a year ago and I had to watch it again. But it's 4 stars for me. I liked it. I thought it was an interesting film.
And what are you saying, Cara?
I'm going the same. I'm going with 4. I'm very interested to see what young Sequin Conor Leach does in the future.
He's very good.
Very interesting actor, yeah. Okay, so 4 from both of you there for Sequin in a blue room. So far, so good in terms of your movie experiences. Let's move on to A Common Crime, an Argentine drama starring Elisa Caricajo, who as a woman whose mind shatters under the weight of collective guilt. Tell us a bit about the character of Cecilia here, played by Elisa Caricajo. As I say, her life in Argentina, Cara.
She's a very successful college professor. She's a single mum, and she has a housekeeper, Neb, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. And the only thing that she's not capable of doing is cooking. Other than that, she's a very capable woman. Mm. And she is set to become the next sort of head professor in her university. So she's really... her aging professor is now about to retire, and she's a shoo-in to get that job because she ticks all the right boxes. She's progressive, she knows her stuff, and she's a solid, successful woman.
However, all of that side of her life is great, but she will regret one decision, or she seems to be regretting one decision that she makes. She doesn't let her housekeeper's son into the house at one point along the way, and that will haunt her forever. It's really about guilt. Is that what we're dealing with here, Paul?
Yeah, and it's about middle class guilt, Sean, and it's complicated further by the whole history of the disappeared in that part of the world, and even recently where there's a real problem with disappearances involving the police. She makes this decision not to let Kevin, who she's only met once and didn't particularly take a shine to, Nebe's son, and it's night. It's at night and it's raining and he's banging on the door. So, I'm not sure how appropriate her guilt is in the end, but it gets to her and she begins to imagine that Kevin's unquiet spirit is haunting her. The pace of this film I actually really liked. It's very un-American, if you like, in the sense that it's very slow. It's all about suggestion and, as you say, her psychological trauma, I suppose you could say. But it's very nicely done, I thought.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the pace of the film, Cara, so I'll come to you on that. Paul, liking that particular pace, but I wondered sometimes in these situations where you have where you're not quite sure whether the person is feeling guilty or whether the person, in fact, there's a question around their mental health. Is that line well demarcated, or in fact, should it not be demarcated? Should you be asking that question all along the way?
She really gets so rattled. She begins to, she even checks on her little son at night to make sure he's still alive. She becomes so erratic. And I terrible thing to say, maybe I'm not quite sure if somebody would really go that far off the rails through guilt. So I just wondered if maybe there was something in her past, and I just would have liked to have seen that played out a bit more. It's a very, very extreme reaction. A terrible thing happens, but you know, it was a horrible night. some man comes banging on your door in the middle of the night, you're a single mum, really, would you let somebody in? I just thought it was just very extreme. It's very claustrophobic and it's really well done in those scenes, but is it a horror? Is it a social conscience film? I think it just gets a bit lost in what it's meant to be.
Yeah, a lot of it then, I presume, for you, Paul, in that it worked for you in that respect. A lot of it is down to Elisa Katakakos' performance.
Yeah, I think her performance is terrific, but she starts the film, she seems like this warm and open-hearted woman, and she's a shell by the end. I would say there's two things in terms of her reaction. The first is her very close friendship with Nebe, and that involves a certain amount of middle-class guilt as well, because she has a maid and she's probably not entirely comfortable, so she makes her friend. And the second thing then is this whole backdrop of the disappeared, and she feels somehow implicated in that. So for me, that then justified her reaction.
So overall, it worked, I think, for you a lot better than it did for Cara. So what are you saying in terms of stars, Paul?
I'm giving it 4 stars, Sean. I really liked it, I have to say.
Cara, was it that lack of clarity, or for you the sudden change that was the problem in your mind? She was gone off the rails too quickly. Was that the problem in the film?
It was more. I think it's two things: that the social elements versus that kind of horror thing. I'm just not sure what it wanted to be. And like, she is excellent and she does such a good performance, but I'm just not sure if a character would go from being the way she was at the start to the end. I do think it's well worth watching, but I still couldn't give it more than a 3.
Right.
It's a good 3, if that makes sense.
A good 3 from you. So a little bit of a difference of opinion then from Paul Whittington and Cara O'Doherty there in terms of our third film, A Common Crime, released tomorrow on digital platforms. Total accord almost on the other two. Sound of Metal, available on Prime Video from April the 12th. And Sequin in a Blue Room, also available on Prime Video. New Pagans are a 5-piece band from Northern Ireland. Their debut album, The Seed, The Vessel, The Roots and All, was hugely received, well received, in fact, when we reviewed it on Arena a few weeks back. Delighted that Claire MacSkimmon and Lindsay McDougall from the band will be joining us in a while to talk about their journey so far. But first of all, let's hear a track from the album. This is Bloody Soil. Bloody Soil, the title of that track there from the album The Seed, The Vessel, The Roots and All from Belfast 5-piece New Pagans. And delighted to be joined this evening by bass player Claire MacSkimmon and singer and lyricist for the band Lindsay McDougall. And Bloody Soil, when you have a band based in the north of Ireland and they come out with a track called Bloody Soil, you wonder what directly are they referring to there? What you're the lyricist here, Lindsay, so give us a sense of what was in your mind with Bloody Soil.
Well, it was really about, I mean, we all grew up during the Troubles in the north of Ireland and we don't romanticise it at all. And this song is really kind of about the fragility of this place, you know, but it's also about the hope and the growth that we have kind of gone through since the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. I mean, we were all kids at that time. I was 15. So it's just like, it's about remembering, isn't it? And it's like, you know, we want to remember the past, but we also want to proceed with caution and hope and just not forget where we've come from. So it's kind of all of that. And I think it's kind of just a poem to Ireland, really.
And that is the way that things generally work in the band, I think, Claire, that Lindsay, more or less, most of the time, she comes in with the lyrics and then the band members work from there.
Well, I think Lindsay is always working away on lyrics in the background, but we would get together in the room and work on the music, and then Lindsay would bring the lyrics to us, and that'll sometimes be the first time that we hear the lyrics to the song.
Was there music in place, as it were, almost, for Bloody Soil before you heard the lyrics at all?
Yeah, I think we had this one pretty much fully formed before Lindsay came in with the lyrics. Am I right, Lindsay?
Yeah, you are. Yeah. So often the band will be working away. I mean, usually they'd go through a series, the songs go through a series of changes, but we start with the music and then I go away on my own and kind of just light a candle and, you know, relax and try and
hope for the best.
And hope for the best. But it's more like, you know, getting like a secure place, like a quiet place that I can just work away on my own and I don't have to worry about how silly it sounds. But usually it just, you know, usually I just write and then it's afterwards I realise what it's about as well, which is kind of a strange way to work maybe.
Yeah, but whatever. Sorry, Lindsay, you were going to say something there? Go ahead.
No, sorry, I was just going to say, I think that's a really interesting way for us to write when we're writing music as well, because the emotion or feelings that we're putting into the song sometimes completely change when the lyrics come in. It's like the little cherry on the top at the end.
Mind you, I'm not surprised that you need to find a quiet place for yourself, Lindsay. It did strike me as I was listening to that piece with the headphones around my ears. It's fairly full on. We were talking about the film Sound of Metal earlier on and the drummer that loses his hearing because of, you know, partly because of the loud music that he's constantly playing. That's a piece of fiction, obviously. But it I know you don't like, bands hate to categorise what they're doing, but it certainly is kind of wall of sound. There's a grungy element in there. There's a punky element in there too.
Yeah, I mean, I think we get called all of those things, and then indie rock is usually thrown in as well. But I mean, we don't mind. We've got so many different influences. I mean, Connor's really loves jazz music and improvisation and very experimental. And then Claire and I and are probably more like the post-punk stuff. And Alan and Connor are very rock, you know. But it's kind of just works. We're not, I think we'll evolve as well. I mean, this is our first, as you've said, it's our first album and this is my first band. So I think we'll evolve. But we do all somehow kind of create this sound together. And I think with the lyrics and the music together, it kind of works at the moment anyway.
And also, Lindsay, it's very, I find interesting that you're a PhD student, Irish history, and embroidery.
Yeah.
They seem like two very different disciplines. Tell me how the two meld together in your studies and researches and how that plays into the music.
Yeah, well, I'm studying Irish history through women's embroidery in places like, you know, the Masonic Lodge and the churches in Ireland. So I'm looking at the whole island of Ireland. But I mean, they come into the songs really because I end up writing about someone like Lily Yates. You know,
explain who she is or was.
Lily Yates is the sister of the famous Yates brothers, the poet and the painter. Mm. And her and her sister actually helped set up the Kula Press and also the embroidery department. And so she's really amazing because she made these beautiful embroidered pictures. And yeah, I just discovered her and I hadn't heard anything about her, you know, and even though I'd been an embroiderer for years and I'd been really interested in embroidery, I didn't know anything about Lily. And then I sort of got a bit annoyed when I discovered that I had never been told anything about her at school, you know. So the song is kind of about that. It's about, like, you know, let's rewrite history a little bit and put women's stories back in, to, especially in Ireland, you know. So it's so that's where the song, kind of the idea for the song came from.
And certainly there's an element of history, I suppose, as well in the yellow wallpaper, a reference back to the Charlotte Perkins Gilman story. And her essay, her story about the wallpaper, a kind of postnatal depression story in some ways. But the video for Yellow Room, I was looking at it and it's quite interesting. You make the videos, Claire. Tell us about, there are designs in the video, these kind of almost kaleidoscopic designs that we see at the beginning of the video.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really fascinated with that kind of like split screen sort of, you know, what images you can make out of other things when you multiply them. I love that. I think it looks amazing. But as far as the Yellow Room video goes, we just had a few sort of images that we knew we wanted to capture. Like we do with all of our videos, we just go out and shoot and we see what we come up with, take it back and see what we can put together. Kind of like putting together a collage, which is how I make a lot of the artwork for the band singles and album artwork.
But the embroidery,
we look kind of the same way.
Yeah, and but the kaleidoscopic things that I'm referring to at the beginning, they look like pieces of lace, and then they kind of mix together like the way that you would if you were looking in a kaleidoscope with a split screen. But those embroideries, you actually made the initial embroideries that are the basis for the video, Lindsay.
Yes, I did. Yeah, the masks and things are all embroidered by me. Yeah, we kind of. Yeah, there was a few different references Claire had of films, and she kind of showed me, and I just thought, I don't know where the mask idea came, but we just started to I started to make these masks with pieces of silk. They took ages, but it was well worth it in the end. There was a really, it was a very disturbing appearance, I think, that it created, which is essentially what the yellow wallpaper, the novel that the song's really based on, is about. You know, it's about that being uncomfortable, being in a place where you really don't know what's next, or you can't remember, you know, and it's sort of that's what we tried to create in the video. And I think the embroideries and the masks and the way Claire all put it all together really worked.
Is there no end, Claire, to the quality of guitar music that we're going to, guitar driven bands, I suppose, in some ways, that we get from Belfast and from Northern Ireland? It seems to be a very healthy scene despite lockdown and despite the absence of live gigs at the moment.
Well, I think lockdown, you know, in some ways will have been a good thing. I was thinking about it today, and I was just thinking about how many people are ready once lockdown ends to come out and start new bands. People must have just been writing in their bedroom this whole year. I'm ready for the new bands.
And I guess you're ready for a couple of live gigs whenever
Absolutely.
We might get those. Let's finish up by having a second track. And again, very potent title, certainly when I saw this one written down. Christian Boys is the track that I'm going to go to. Tell me a little bit about this one, Lindsay.
Yeah, it was sparked by one of my friends, a story that she had, and she was treated very unfairly by a Christian man. But it's really more, it became more than that, because it was really written about, you know, the injustice of us victim blaming as a society. We often blame the victims, and especially in Ireland we have to take a look at ourselves, you know, and it's really a call for people and communities and churches to take responsibility for, you know, abuse and crimes against our most vulnerable. And it's a very strong song, but I think again it offers hope. And at the end, you know, of the song, I kind of say, you know, it's not my fault, this is all on you. And that's kind of what I hope people get out of it, you know.
Well, listen, great to have spoken with both of you this evening, and congratulations on the Best Live Act Award that you won in the Northern Ireland Music Prize. That was for 2020. I'm sure there'll be more of that to come on the basis of the wall of sand that I'm about to put at people once again. Great to speak with you both this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Not at all. Thank you both. Claire MacSkimmon, and who's the bass player and singer and lyricist, Lindsay McDougall there of New Pagans. And here is that track, Christian Boys.
First of all, the tale's a curse that comforts bitterness. It's a dream. Her hands see the old forgetting me. Violently shapes the quickened thoughts that set you free. Tyrant's guide, the spirit of her alchemy. And more, I need more of this, I know, until I
That is the sound of the Belfast-based band New Pagans, a track called Christian Boys, and that track is taken from their debut album, which is called The Seed, The Vessel, The Roots and All. Born in Cork in 1875, Hugh Lane, art collector and gallery director, came from respectable but perhaps impoverished stock. His father was an Anglican minister. His mother was sister to Lady Gregory. That connection with Gregory opened doors for him in the London art world of the 1890s as an apprentice dealer. And he had an extraordinary eye for art, especially old masters and French impressionists. This won him fame and fortune. The final great act of a life cut short in 1915 was the campaign for and for to found a municipal gallery of art by living artists, and that to be based in Dublin and for the citizens of Dublin. His life and times were captured in the drama documentary Citizen Lane, which came out in 2018 and is about to be released on digital platforms, including iTunes, Amazon and Google. Historian and consultant to the film, Roy Foster, joins me this evening. Roy, I suppose the first thing that all, I think really to put Hugh Lane in the context, when we think of what was going on at the beginning of the 20th century in Ireland, and when we think of how the arts fed into what was happening politically at the time, it's often from the side of poetry, it's from the side of theatre, it's from the side of the written word. It's not often from the side of the visual arts. Hugh Lane had a very different idea. He felt that the visual arts, I think, should have played just as big a role as any other art form in cultural nationalism.
You're right, John. It's the missing part of the jigsaw, in a way. Lane believed that Ireland, to be a modern cosmopolitan European country, needed to be exposed to European art. It's very important that these are, by and large, French paintings that he was trying to introduce into a permanent gallery in the heart of Dublin. And they are, for the day, avant-garde French paintings. And he was... He was a great pioneer in this. As you say correctly, he was himself an expert in old masters, but on a visit to Paris in 1904 with William Orpin, great Irish painter, he discovered Impressionism and, well, as well, Post-Impressionism by then, and began buying Manets and Monets and Vuillard and Pissarro and Degas, and the nucleus of this extraordinary collection that has been disputed since his premature death on the Lusitania.
And you know, you see, because we say now, well, of course he bought Monets, and of course he bought Manets, and of course he bought Degas. Why wouldn't he? But we've got to think, as you said there, Roy, this is at the very early stages of post-impressionism, I suppose, really. So he was taking a risk. And was he bringing these paintings back to a fairly conservative-minded Ireland in terms of what their visual arts?
He was and he wasn't. The market for avant-garde French painting at the turn of the century is interesting. Glasgow millionaires are buying them. There's a couple of Welsh sisters who build a great collection, but the London taste is behind that. And the trustees of the National Gallery in London, for instance, think that when he tries to lend them initially things like Renoir's Les Parapluies, they think they aren't worth hanging. They tell him they aren't worth hanging. They leave them in their basement. You know, it's an avant-garde taste. But Dublin is a kind of cynosure of artistic experimentation in the early years of the century. Okay, there's a conservative presence, but there are also people like Sarah Purser, like W.B. Yeats, like Augusta Gregory, prepared to go out on a limb to have these things established in Ireland as part of seeing Ireland as a modern European country.
And I guess when you think of the other Yeats, when you think of Jack B. Yeats and the kind of paintings that he was making, not quite impressionistic, but kind of almost moving on from even post-impressionism into a kind of expressionism in some ways.
Absolutely. Yes, no, there is a radicalism, I think, in Irish art, which has been underestimated, and to a certain extent there was a radical taste for Irish art as well, not alas among the members of the Dublin Corporation by and large, who caused the difficulty about Lane choosing a site for his new gallery, but certainly among the intelligentsia and among the what Flann O'Brien called the plain people as well. There was an appetite for seeing these things.
And in fact, it was perhaps those difficulties with the members of the various councils in Dublin and dealing with the finances of that sent him on that ill-fated trip to America to actually get some money together.
Well, he'd sold a Titian for £50,000. I mean, this is the sort of money that he moved in. One thing we should say about him as well, John, is that he was a radical in that he believed in free entry into the galleries. The temporary modern gallery he founded in Clonmel House in Harcourt Street in 1908, entry there was free, and people did come in and throng the stairs, seeing these extraordinary paintings like Manet's Eva González hanging there. It must have been a revelation, and that's what he wanted to establish. And a century after that, in 2008, Barbara Dawson, the director of the Hulin Gallery here, reassembled the 39 disputed paintings and hung them together. And it was a revelation to see this profile of a radical collector's taste and what he wanted to do with this amazing collection.
Yeah, it's very interesting what she says in the film about that, when she talks about, you know, when the 39 paintings were brought back together, brought back for in 2008 for the centenary of Hugh Lane's death, that really, when you saw all 39 together, you realise these should never be anywhere else but in one place and together. Yeah, they might move around and be loaned for a little while, but they should be together as a unit. So explain. Let's start with the initial row about these paintings. Let's go right back to Hugh Lane gets on the Lusitania, and as we know, unfortunately, his life is lost there. What was the situation with the 39 paintings at that point? Why were they in London?
He'd had this great row with Dublin Corporation in 1913 about the site for a gallery. He'd had a hissy fit, and he had first tried to lend the paintings to the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square in London. He then privately decided he would give them to them. And he made a will in 1913, leaving the paintings, the 39 paintings, to teach Dublin a lesson. He was going to leave them to London. Mm. But between then and his death, 2 years, things changed radically. For one thing, he became director of the National Gallery in Ireland, in Merrion Square, and his feelings towards Dublin and Ireland changed. For another thing, the National Gallery in London behaved, as I've already said, in a very Philistine way about the paintings, and that offended him. So he made a codicil to his will, which he initialed every page of, leaving the paintings back to Dublin. Then he got in the Lusitania and was drowned when it was torpedoed, but he hadn't had the codicil witnessed, so it was deemed illegal, holding legal weight.
And that has been the legal argument that the National Gallery in London and that the British have always
That has
put
been
forward.
The legal argument, and it's a complicated argument, John, because if you'd been a soldier and died in action in the First World War, you didn't have to have a codicil witnessed. If you were in Scotland, you didn't have to have a codicil witnessed. Not often, but on certain famous occasions, a codicil has been, unwitnessed codicils have been retrospectively recognised by an Act of Parliament. It can be done. But what's happening from 1915 on, and especially from around 1918 on, is the value of these things are becoming stratospheric. The taste has caught up with them. They're now absolutely, well, they become priceless, almost literally.
They're out of the basement in the National Gallery of the London.
They're well out of the basement.
Yeah, they're up on the walls now. There's a great story as well in 1956 then, that the two boys, one of the great art heists in some ways. It is a lovely story. And it was.
This is lovely. This is Paul Hogan and William Fogarty, two students who were very exercised, as many of us are, about the injustice of this, walked into the Tate Gallery and just took the Bette Morisot of the two women on the boat in the river, a very beautiful painting, and wrapped it up in brown paper and walked down the steps with it and said they were holding it to ransom. And it was a very awkward situation for the Tate Gallery, for one thing, because it showed what their security was like, but also Anglo-Irish relations. It was returned through the Irish Embassy, but it was one of a number of incidents when the whole situation was given a certain high profile.
Yeah, but then, you know, now we're today, and particularly around, if you think around the time that the film was made, we were coming out of that extraordinary period when Queen Elizabeth had visited Ireland, you know, and had made that statement about, you know, things that, you know, should have been different or shouldn't have happened at all. I mean, I remember I was happened to be nearby that table when that speech was made at the banquet, and you know, those words in Dublin Castle, coming from the Queen of England, saying there are things in history that should never have happened. I mean, those were extraordinary words. You would have thought that the climate was such, certainly in the middle part, the 2015 through to maybe the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, actually, I quoted those very words when I made a speech, a lecture in the National Gallery in London on the anniversary of the sinking of the Lusitania. They unwisely asked me to give a lecture about Hugh Lane. And I made it a bit of a manifesto for this. And the then director of the gallery, Nicholas Penny, who was in the audience, said that Ireland did have a moral right to the pictures, which was we thought, an advance.
Yeah.
But it should be said quickly, John, that the situation has been changed very recently.
Yeah, so tell us what has changed. Tell us what has changed in recent times.
Well, the National Gallery in London and Barbara Dawson, representing the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin, have got a new arrangement now whereby the 10 priceless paintings are divided into two groups of five, and they'll alternate between London and Dublin in groups of five. So they'll be more regularly seen in both capitals. But to my mind, the really important thing is that now they're going to be credited differently. If you saw the film, you'll know that I stand on the steps of the National Gallery denouncing in righteous rage the fact that all these pictures are labelled that they belong to the National Gallery in London. They'll now be labelled National Gallery in partnership with the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin.
Yeah.
Which is a big...
Well, it's a move. It's a move forward. But, I mean, I did notice in the film as well that the then director of the National Gallery of London, Dr. Gabriel Finaldi, he says, oh, so things are great now. This was in a previous year, and things are great now. Lane's desire that the pictures should be seen in Dublin. And he emphasises the word seen himself. Why shouldn't they be here? Yes, they can go on loan. Why shouldn't all 39 be here? Shouldn't they be in the Hugh Lane Gallery where they belong? Where, you know, do you think this is a step in the right direction? Do you think it can ever get to that point?
Yes, I'm totally with you there. Many of us would think that they should be labelled property of the Hugh Lane Gallery Dublin and lent kindly occasionally to the National Gallery in London. But Dr. Finaldi's line in that interview in that film was, the polite word would be disingenuous, and I think that the new arrangement is far nearer the justice that should actually be done. And I think that the galleries, both the gallery in London and especially Barbara Dawson and the gallery in Charlemagne Square, in Parnell Square, deserve great credit for arranging this better.
So do you think
situation.
It is a case of just be patient? It may come in time, but we have to wait for that time to come?
Eventually, I hope.
Right.
Time, the great healer.
Time is a great healer. And it would be lovely to see all 39 of them together on a more regular basis, for sure. Lovely to have spoken with you this evening, Roy. Thanks for being with us.
And you, thanks for having me.
That's Roy Foster. And the film that we were speaking about there, Citizen Lane, which is a kind of a mixture of documentary and drama, with Tom Von Lawler playing the character of Hugh Lane. Citizen Lane will be available on iTunes, Amazon, on Google, from April the 12th. But that is our lot for this Thursday evening here in Arena. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Damien Chanel was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme, produced by Keishi. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio.